Oh, he's not. That's just okay.
Yeah, she gave you a thumb.
Okay, there it is. I'll call the Environmental Quality Board to order, and we will start with the adoption of the consent agenda, proposed agenda for the June 20th board meeting. You should have in front of you, and also the minutes of the April 18th meeting. And the motion itself would be in order.
So moved.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Is there further discussion on the motion to approve the agenda and the minutes of the April 18th meeting? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Introductions, I think we'll start with John Hara and go around the room for the benefit of the cameras and Mike. Mr. Hardy.
John Hara Hardy, Commissioner, Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Al Hornberg, Citizen Member of Congressional District 1.
Shawn Tara Hardy, Commissioner. That's my normal voice. Shawn Tara Hardy, Commissioner, Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Thank you. Al. Al Forsberg, Citizen Rep, Congressional District 1.
Jessica Luman, Commissioner of the Department of Commerce.
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation.
Julie Gehring, Citizen Member from District 7.
Eddie Tollison. Ah, there we go, okay. Citizen Member from District 2.
Gerald Vandenberg, I'm Chair of the Bowser Board.
Yeah, so Tom Moebi, Citizen Member, District 2.
Tom Ledward, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of Health Department.
John Saxall, nope. Testing. How's that sound? John Saxhog, Citizen Member, District 5.
Hand it to me.
And Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Department of Agriculture.
I'm playing with it.
Try that one off
here. Yeah, that one. This one's on. John Stein, Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. John, you want me to do it for you, John?
Check, check, check. Stein. Now it's on.
Dave, now you're on. All right, okay. Maybe we drop back and start in the back. Jim, Bob, and then we'll work.
Always around
you. Oh, yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Hello. Han Zehua, EQB stuff.
David Bell, Minnesota Department of Health, Tech Rep.
Ray Kirsch, Minnesota Department of Commerce, Tech Rep.
Kate Fairman, Department of Natural Resources, Tech Rep.
Deborah Moynihan, MnDOT, Tech Rep.
Jim Kelly with the Minnesota Department of Health.
Bob Patton, Tech Rep, Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Jeff Berg, Water Policy Specialist, Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Annie Felix-Girth, Bowser, Tech Rep.
Anita Anderson, Department of Health.
Steve Roos, Department of Agriculture.
Jaslyn Winkler, intern at Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Katie Pratt, EQB.
Andy Holdsworth, DNR.
Pam Anderson, Pollution Control Agency.
Eric Dahl, EQB.
It's okay. We'll just move ahead. Thank you. Thank you, each and every one of you, for taking the time to be here today. The chair's report is the executive director had to leave us for an appointment at 1 o'clock, so he will not be able to be here for the balance of the meeting. From a chair's perspective, if I could just take a minute, personal privilege, and thank all of you for the warm hugs that you have given Kay and me over the last several weeks following the death of our daughter. The kindness that you have shown is, I can't find the words to describe it, but I just know that we've felt your embrace, all of you, over the past several weeks. Thank you. Let's go then, before I cry, to number five on the agenda. I think we should be able to move through the agenda fairly rapidly today. I should be able to be out of here at least well before 4 o'clock. And if you have commitments that you have to leave for, I understand that. Please do so. We'll start with the Environmental Quality Board Energy and Environment Report Card. Water indicators. Eric is going to, Eric Cedarly Dahl will be leading it off. And we're joined by staff from four agencies, the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, the Department of Pollution, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Department of Natural Resources. And thank you all for taking the time to see you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the board, I'm Eric Cedarleaf Dahl, and I have with me Pam Anderson from the Pollution Control Agency, Andy Holdsworth from the DNR, James Kelly from Department of Health, and Bob Patton from MDA. They're going to be presenting from the 2017 Environment and Energy Report Card, and then what we might expect to see for the 2019 version of the E&E Report Card. So briefly, before they start, we're going to hear about current status of today's all about water. And we're first going to hear about current status of water and trends, and then we'll hear from Bob about water research in the digital library. And then Katie Pratt and I will discuss the past state water plans and then current future planning for the 2020 state water plan. And then we'll hear about some emerging issues related to water. So first we're going to start with Pam, and I'm going to sit back there so everybody's got space.
Chair, members of the board, thank you. So I just wanted to give you a quick overview of kind of the measures that the Pollution Control Agency contributes to the report. So I am going to talk to our lake and river water quality measures.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. Pam Anderson of the Pollution Control Agency. So I just want to give a quick overview of the measures that we contribute for the report. Our measures are driven by the Clean Water Act, the goal that all of our waters will be fishable and swimmable. In Minnesota, the way that we represent that data is by looking at our healthy biological communities and streams. So are the fish there? Are the bugs there for the fish to eat? And in our lakes, can we swim in them? Is the water clear? Is it low in nutrients? You know, do people want to recreate in our waters? So those are the measures I'm going to cover for us today. The first one up on the screen is our rivers and streams measure. What you see on the left is what we presented for the 2017 report, and what you see on the right is what is a draft version of what you will see in the upcoming 2019 report. Our status hasn't changed. We're kind of bouncing around that 40 to 70% of our lakes and streams support either the swimming or the fishing uses. And we haven't quite covered the entire state yet, so we're kind of still filling out the whole picture to understand what things look like. In the graphic on the right, you can kind of see that hashed area in the middle of the map that will be updated by the time this publication goes to print. We're in the works of getting those numbers updated. So what we're looking for on the rivers and streams, again, is a healthy biological community. So the bugs, the fish, we want to see a diverse community, all sorts of different types of critters in the water. And then we want to make sure that the sensitive species, the ones that can't tolerate pollution, are still there. So we don't want those species to start being absent. So that is our river metric. The next page is taking a look at our lake information. Again, same setup. On the left, you will see the information we presented in the 2017 report. On the right, you'll see the information, the draft information for the 2019. Again, those hashed areas will be updated in time for the publication of the report. Similar to streams, we also are kind of maintaining that 40 to 70% are meeting our standards. I should have touched on the scale in the previous graphic. It's kind of your stoplight colors. Red is poor. We have very few waters that are meeting our standards, all the way up to green and blue, where most of the waters are actually meeting the standards, the blue being greater than 80% of the waters we collected information on are actually supporting the fishing or swimming uses. And just a reminder, again, in lakes, we're looking at, in particular, nutrients. So we want to see low levels of nutrients, and we want to see high levels of water clarity. You want to be able to see your toes when you're standing in the water. So these patterns kind of follow the land use that we see across the state, where we have more heavily disturbed land use, whether it's agricultural, urban, forestry practices. You know, where we have heavily altered the landscape, we tend to see more issues than in the areas that are more intact. And then kind of the what's coming up in the report, you know, I did mention that we will have five more of those watersheds updated in time for the publication of the report. The change from the 2017 report to this one will be an additional 16 watersheds that we've completed information on. So that's a pretty good chunk of the state, particularly that central swath will be complete. We only have six watersheds left, so by the time the following report comes through, we will have that statewide picture complete. So just kind of getting closer to our end goal of having the state monitored. And then we're hoping to highlight some of our success stories, particularly in rural areas where, you know, there's not necessarily as much financial input into some of these projects. In southwest Minnesota, First Fulda Lake was a pretty high-profile success story, and it was a lot of local boots-on-the-ground work, farmers coming together with the city and other groups to really make some positive change. And then up in our northeast, the Poplar River, that was a lot of local work to address erosion kind of upstream and working near shore. So just trying to highlight that we are starting to see some improvements based on the work that folks are doing. Pass that to Andy.
Any questions for Pam, or do you want to just make the report, Eric, and then follow either
of us? Okay. Hi, I'm Andy Holdsworth with Department of Natural Resources, and I'm going to talk about sustainable water use. I think the report makes very clear in that yellow box that really, a sufficient water supply is just vital to our public health, economy, and the environment. And in this report, there's two indicators related to sustainable water use. Really, the change in the amount of water used per capita, but also the trends in groundwater levels in observation wells. And so the first one indicator is shown here. And so this shows the water use since 1997. This is reported water use in the categories for public water supplies, industrial uses, irrigation, and other uses. It excludes power generation because the water just kind of goes through the plants and back out. And so the key thing is this is the percent change that on the vertical scale from 97 to 2015. And so we have actually added the last 2 points, 2015 and 2016, to this report. So the key thing here is reported water use. You see that dark blue line has generally been increasing over this 20-year period. But once you then divide that by the population, which has been increasing over this time period, you see that lower orange line, which is the actual indicator that we're tracking here. So we'd like to, you know, keep the change steady and not increase, certainly. And so in the last, okay, so yeah, I'm orienting. This was, so to 2015, it was looked stable for the 20 years. So in the next report, you'll see that in the recent 2 years, it's actually declined per relative to 1997. So that's a good thing. It's really attributed to where we've had, in terms of municipal water supply and agricultural irrigation, having fewer demands because we've had generally some wetter years, especially in the summer months. And so that's a really important thing to keep in mind here is that in the long term, this is, you know, both weather, but also, you know, cumulative effects of pumping and then specific demands in particular geographic areas. So some wet years and some dry years can make a big difference. So what we'll see in the next report is this should turn to green because the criteria for this indicator, if there's been a 1.5% decrease from the previous year, then, you know, we will say that that is green. That's a positive trend, but that is just over that short period of time. So let me move to groundwater level trends. So this is what you see here is dots representing 341 groundwater observation wells. Across the state, you can see some areas where we have very few wells, and these are pretty special wells in that they're wells that have at least 20 years of data. And so it's currently 341. This shows the updated data since the last report. So we have five more years of data, and and I think what the trigger is kind of a conservative trigger, which is the lowest water level in the well is what is recorded each year. So we want to, so that's just important to say. And these are data that we use with many other data sets. It's really important for evaluating kind of water sustainability to identify concerns in particular areas. So the blue symbols are wells where the trend has been upward over that 20-year period, the gray symbols of where there's been no trend, stable, and then the yellow symbols where there's been a downward trend. So downward trends can result, again, from drier conditions in the climate, especially in the later years of this analysis period, or increased groundwater use. So of these 341 wells, there's 81% that are upward in terms of their trend and or no trend. So that's a good sign. 19%, you know, left where there's been that downward trend. Now, I should also note the last 20 years has been the driest period, I mean the wettest period on record in Minnesota. If we had a drier period, these trends would be different, likely. So the key thing, you know, I think, and it's really important, what is happening is greater investment in our groundwater monitoring network. The more wells we have with this longer period of data in order to support analysis like this is really absolutely critical at a statewide scale, but especially in areas where there's real demands and there's focused effort through like groundwater management areas to try to achieve sustainable water use. But I think, again, it's raising awareness that water is not unlimited in the state. In particular areas, we can have shortages and demands at particular periods of time. Okay, thanks.
I am. I'm Bob Patton. I'm with Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm co-presenting on nitrate with Jim Kelly from Department of Health, and also here in the room is Jeff Berg, who's our water quality specialist here at the Department of Ag, who contributed a great deal to the 2017 report. So I wanted to start off with, we're talking about nitrate. Nitrate was featured in the 2017 report, will be again in the 2019 report, because it's one of the most common water pollutants in Minnesota. And the first slide here that I have wasn't in the 2017 report, and I don't believe will be in the 2019 report either, but is on our website. And it's just kind of showing the complexity, and a lot of the theme here is complexity of nitrogen moving through the water cycle, nitrogen manifests itself in a whole bunch of different forms throughout the environment, going from the atmosphere to the ground to the water. And one of those forms is nitrate, which forms in the soil, and you can see it in the lower right. Nitrate can, of course, is taken up by plants, but it also can leach into the soil, into the groundwater, and then thereby to surface waters as well. And so that's the issue that we are concerned about as Minnesotans. Also, I'll note that you'll note that it goes up into the air, denitrifies, and turns into nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas. And so that was another piece that Jeff and I collaborated quite a bit on in the CZO report, in the Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities report. Nitrate, got to keep to my notes here. Nitrate is challenging and complex. It's under row crop production in vulnerable soils, nitrate leaching will occur. Losses may vary significantly between years due to weather. There may be long lag times between changes in practices and changes in groundwater quality. And there's enormous variability between and within aquifers. And so it's, again, really complex and difficult to solve and also difficult to describe in a report, which we found in 2017 and we're confronting again. I'm going to walk you through what the 2017 page looked like a little bit and some of the elements of it, and then try to touch on what we anticipate to be in the 2019 report. The indicator itself, you can see it's shown to be red and trending flat. The metric itself is based on regional private well monitoring networks in two vulnerable areas of the state, the southeast and central Minnesota. And these are networks in partnership with local governments, the MDH and the MDA. The goal we set for the report is an ambitious one, 100% of the wells meeting the state's health risk limit. And so the 2017 color was red because in southeast Minnesota, there were less than 95% of the wells meeting the health risk limit, and less than 98% in central Minnesota meeting those limits. The reason it's trending flat was because there was no statistically significant upward or downward trend. These were the graphics that were in the report. And they show nitrate concentrations in, on the left, community source water supply wells, and on the right, on private wells. Those private wells are from the MDA's township testing program. We don't plan to use these maps in the 2019 report. We found they were busy and hard to understand. And so instead, we plan to show one map that simply shows areas vulnerable to high nitrates due to their soils and geology. These are primarily, again, in the southeast and central Minnesota and some other areas in the state with coarse textured soils and shallow to bedrock. There will also be displaying the DWSMAs, the drinking water supply management areas. And the main point of the map is that some of the areas of the state are more at risk for high nitrates than others. We featured in 2017, we'll probably feature it again, the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. And this is a voluntary program where really it's a process where of really whole farm assessment of risks on the farm and farmers that treat all their risks, become certified and obtain regulatory certainty for a period of 10 years. Right now, we have 585 producers in the program, over 371,000 acres, and over 1,000 new practices through the program. And I'm sure the commissioner could probably give me a whole bunch more details than I know. Also, you may know that there's a lot happening with the fertilizer management, the groundwater protection rule right now, which is related to the fertilizer management plan. The fertilizer management plan is the state's blueprint for minimizing groundwater impacts, and it's emphasizes involving local farmers and agronomists in problem solving the groundwater concerns. Really the origin goes back to 1989 of the Groundwater Protection Act. The first nitrogen fertilizer management plan was drafted in 1990, and this version was a five-year process that involved a whole lot of public input. MDA recently published the Groundwater Protection Rule, and the purpose of that rule is to minimize potential fertilizer sources of nitrogen pollution in the groundwater and protect drinking water. The process in the Groundwater Protection Rule for addressing DWSMAs with high nitrate is based on the approach in the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan. And there are is a whole lot of process that's gone on. There were 17 listening sessions across the state last summer, the MDA made significant changes to the proposed rule based on those comments. There are upcoming the informational meetings are almost done. I thought we have public meetings coming up. These are actually with the ALJ, and there are eight of them coming up. Anyway, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five public meetings coming up. Participate, people can write comments or they can attend the public hearings. And I'm going to turn it over to Jim.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm really here today to talk a little bit about a document that appears in your packet that's a information sheet that the Department of Health prepared in April to kind of describe the health concerns associated with exposures to nitrate in water. From our meetings that our colleagues at the Agriculture Department have had over the course of the past year on the proposed rule, from items that have appeared in the popular press, there seems to be some skepticism in some quarters about the health risks associated with exposure to nitrate in groundwater. And in some ways, it's kind of a forgotten contaminant because much of the health risks that were documented associated with nitrate exposure took place many decades ago. But that's not to say that nitrates still don't pose a health risk to humans when they're consuming it from groundwater, especially infants. And so we thought it would be helpful to go back and summarize the actual work that was done back in the 1940s and 50s, much of which was done right here in Minnesota, that documented the health concerns associated with exposure to nitrate with regards to infants and a particular health condition called methemoglobinemia that can result when infants are exposed to elevated nitrates in groundwater through their formula, through mixing that water to create formula. In many ways, the type of work that produced the standard, both the national standard, the MCL for nitrate, as well as our state value, was done on the basis of observational studies that took place right here in Minnesota and were published in the scientific literature. In many ways, when we establish health protective guidelines for contaminants in groundwater, it's based on animal studies where they're dosed with various levels of chemicals, and we make a number of adjustments because animals aren't humans and the results don't always translate directly. That's not the case with nitrate. Nitrate was based on observational studies where it was very clear where the patterns emerged, that infants who were exposed to levels of nitrate above 10 milligrams per liter in the 1940s and 50s, many of them were found to have methemoglobinemia. Infants who were seeing their doctor did not have those symptoms almost invariably had levels below 10 milligrams per liter. So that's where the level was established to be a protective level for infants who have might be consuming nitrate in groundwater that's used to make formula. There's obviously been questions, well, why aren't we seeing this here today? And there may be some reasons for that contribute to that. But the bottom line is that it could be occurring. And it's not a reportable condition. It's not something that If the physicians are required to report if they see a case of that. We did do some checking in our hospitalization records, emergency department records. We see evidence of infants with methemoglobinemia. We don't have enough information to tie it directly back to a well water exposure, but we can't rule it out either. So there's additional work that could be done, but really our goal at this point was just to get this information out for the public so they could see just what we do know about nitrate exposure in groundwater and why it's important and why it's a problem that can still exist. It's a public health success story, I think, to the point where it's not as common as it was 40, 50, 60 years ago. But that's not a reason to relax our guard and go back to a situation where infants could be sickened and even die from exposure to elevated nitrates in groundwater. So, again, our rationale for producing this document was to get this information, get what we know and what's been documented in Minnesota in the past out in the public's arena so that to kind of serve as a reminder as to why it's important to continue to address nitrate in groundwater from an exposure to infant standpoint. So that's all I wanted to share. We've made this document available on our website. We've been providing it to our colleagues at the Agriculture Department for their processes and been sharing it with other folks around the state as well. So thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Questions for the presenters? Please.
Were nitrate levels lower back in the 40s, I'm sorry, higher back in the 40s and 50s when this disease was being observed and lower now, which seems counter to the amount of nitrogen being applied in the agricultural areas now?
That's a very good question. I think the levels in some many ways are comparable to what the MDA has been observing in their township testing program. And they're obviously probably management of nitrate fertilizers has improved over that time and maybe resulted in less loading overall. But many of the values that were reported in the studies that we summarized in this document are sometimes a little bit higher than what we're commonly seeing now, but they're certainly in the same ballpark.
John? Andy, is there a way to index the per capita water use to difference in average annual precip? So one of the things that I would really like us to develop over time is a better metric, mm-hmm. because the goal is to use less water when it's dry and when it's wet. I think the consumption and conservation practices, it's a tricky index to develop, but I really think we should think about mm-hmm. how to index water per capita water use to precip.
That's a great point, Commissioner Stein. I was actually discussing that with a colleague today. I will pass that on as a really important thing to do. For instance, we in tracking our energy use, as all state agencies do, we just began to normalize or index our energy use based on what makes sense, which is some years have many more heating degree days, colder winters, and or hotter summers and then cooling degree days, and that you should normalize your energy use to that to take out that signal. So we've started to do that for our energy data, and that's a really important thing to do. And so I will take that back. It's, a really important thing to consider and try to do.
Other questions?
I'm wondering about the first set of maps of the wells, of the groundwater testing wells. There weren't very many in Southeast and South Central, and then there can you clarify for me why there wouldn't be many there?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Well,
yeah, it was actually the MPCA map,
yep.
Right?
So the MPCA map. Well, so there was the nitrate, there are two areas on the map.
Your initial groundwater.
Okay, initial groundwater. You're right. There weren't many observation wells there for levels. So with respect to groundwater levels, again, I think the driving reason is having 20 years of data, and that it just happens that those are newer wells, or they've been didn't meet other criteria to provide a reliable data source.
So does that mean there are monitoring wells down there, but they're not 20-year data?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks. That's what I wanted to know.
is my question is, how does wells that are going up or down relate to where there's heavy groundwater used by cities or where there's irrigation? It seems counter to what I would expect, where in the metro there's heavy use of groundwater for water supply, but those are blue. And south central on the Iowa line, there are some that are declining, and there's no irrigation down there and very few people. Do you see any relation between the irrigation and the population use of groundwater and whether it's going up or down? Or is it just a minor consideration considering the changes in rainfall and so on?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge I'm... Yeah, actually, call a friend. I'm not an expert on that, but I will say, I mean, for our hydrologists and groundwater modelers in our agency and many other agencies, they are certainly paying close attention to the multiple factors, and that could influence well levels, including, you know, the proximity to major water withdrawals, and obviously the interference between one water use and another water use, or one water users and another water users, is a really important thing that even statutorily we have to keep track of. But that's a whole nother discussion to bring in some experts to really have a good answer.
So, Pam, I'm curious if we have looked in our lake, you know, swimmable considerations on blue-green algae and any reported beach closures and incidents of, what's the bacteria, Jim, that...
Cyanobacteria.
So the idea that we've been measuring swimmable sort of from a lake clarity point of view, which is about public perception for the most part, but then there's also this actual health statistical information that I wonder if we've tried to combine any of that in this, in our report.
Commissioner Stein? So I will take my best stab at that one. For our lake monitoring across the state and what produces these maps, we have information on about 4,000 lakes across the state, water quality information. We have been limited in our ability, partly cost-wise, just setting something up to kind of dive real deep into the cyanobacteria. We do randomized studies once every 5 years, and we get information on about 150 lakes across the state, so we are starting to get some information. We've had, since we started tracking it in 2004 and working with the health department, the waterborne diseases unit in particular, we've had about 24 reported dog deaths. About half of those are suspected to actually be blue-green related, and other ones we couldn't really conclusively determine. So it's kind of one-ish per year that is actually reported to us, and we've had one child illness that was confirmed in 2015. So it's out there. I think the question is risk, how big of a risk it is. We don't have the information to... be able to track it at a measure like this, but we're working on comparing ourselves with EPA guidelines and neighboring states to try to figure out what we're similar right now to Wisconsin and some of our neighboring states. And then when you get more to where it's impacting drinking water, such as Toledo, Ohio, and those areas, they have much more robust programs, but it's sort of a different beast. It's becoming more of a drinking water issue. We do have, through the health department, with the unregulated contaminant monitoring program, there has been some algal toxin monitoring done. The city of Fairmont, in particular, has participated in that. And we're kind of in the loop on what's going on there, and also working with the non-community program to come up with some better materials to share with our resort owners who might be withdrawing water from some of those lakes up north. So more of an educational campaign at this point.
No.
No. Next meeting.
Yeah, nice try.
All right, thank you very much. Let's go to the overview of the Minnesota Water Research Digital Library, and Bob, you're going to present. present.
Yeah, Steve, you want to come up?
That's the reason you're staying in the chair.
Come on up.
Yes, you get me again. I am still Bob Patton with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm really, I asked Steve Roos to come up here, and Steve is our administrator of the library, and so he's going to answer the questions that I won't be able to answer if there are any. We're going to try to keep this brief, but really, I really especially owe a debt to Katie Pratt, who expressed interest when she learned about the library. She said, you know, we've got to get this on the agenda. And I really appreciate that, because this is probably the resource that, you know, nobody knows about. And we want more people to know about this and use it and partake. I guess I need that thing. So the Water Research Digital Library is what it says. It's a digital library, which means it's a repository of research documents, PDFs for the most part, and information about them. And if you think of it as a library, it's the book in PDF form, and then the library card tells you information about that resource, so you can look at the information and figure out if you want to dive into that, and it's organized like a library, so you can find things. And the origin of this was really we had a former employee who is now with DNR, Barbara Wiseman, who did a lot of interagency work, and the question started coming up in the ag community, particularly with TMDLs, that consultants that working on these short timelines of TMDL plans were really struggling to find relevant research for to be able to put in those to support agriculture. And so Barbara started working on that issue and looking into potential solutions, and in conversations with agencies found that there was general interest in that. So she developed some ideas that eventually went to the through the process to get legacy funding, and we got legacy funding to develop the library. So you can see the purposes to be able to have a searchable share and coordinate in water research relevant to Minnesota. You see a reference to gray literature on that second bullet. That was a really important objective of the library. You can do a Google Scholar search and find literature that's in the publications, in the scientific publications, but it's difficult to find government reports. Sometimes there are engineering memos and things like that that are research. They're hard research, but they're hard to find. And so that's what that gray literature means, and that's a big objective we focused on, and it's an an interagency project to cross disciplines, and so we thought that's a good reason to bring this before the EQB, since that's what you're all about. It exists as an interagency project, but it's operated by the Department of Agriculture. We have a $50,000 a year budget from the Clean Water Fund. And just what's in the library, this scope slide kind of talks about it. It has to have to do with Minnesota, or at least be relevant to Minnesota, have a connection to certain topics of interest in terms of water research. And it needs to be research, which at least a clear and direct connection to water research. We are just accomplished a transition to a new platform, which was a big deal, and Steve was the shepherd of this process. The original library was built at some great cost and angst in terms of a custom-built database, by state government. To contain the library, and it launched in 2014, and it's operated reliably. It's been we've been slowly growing it, But we saw an opportunity, kind of by accident. We were talking with the people at PALS, which is an arm of libraries or the colleges, Minnesota Minsky system. And so they really operate, do technical work for libraries, and they made known to us that they have this platform called Islandora that's a repository platform. And looking into it, we saw huge cost advantages, and also it gave us a lot more flexibility. So we just transitioned to this new platform, which if we come back, we'll show you how it works. There are about, over 2,500 documents in the library right now, and they're spread across 16 main topics, and you can kind of see that spread in this slide. And use has, we've had, small but steady use, and we're still getting the word out and starting with really agencies and interested parties. So these are our statistics that show up and down use over the life of the library since it was launched in 2014. And then we have recent statistics with the transition to the new platform. So since the transition, we've had about 500 visitors, and we've had about 85 downloads since April. We feel that lost the wheel, yeah. So I'll be careful here. So I'm going to hold. Yeah, his job is to hold up the table. We feel this really has some benefits for state agencies and local governments as well. But state agencies, there are a lot of documents of interest in state agencies and to state agencies as well. But one of the problems that we're confronting at the Department of Ag, and I think all agencies are starting to run into, is we've tended to, when we have documents, we make PDFs of them and we put them on our website, and we put them on our website, and we put them on our, and pretty soon we have this really hard to find, hard to navigate website with all these documents we don't know what to do with. And now we're going through a process at the Department of Ag of redoing our website, and we're being told, well, we've got to get a lot of these things off our website. So what do we do with these? A lot of them are still useful documents. Even some old documents are pretty useful for water quality. Mineral offers an alternative to that. It's a permanent repository. As long as we have funding to run it, we'll be running it. It's again, it functions as a searchable library, well organized, and so we think it's something that we hope we can encourage our brethren and other agencies to really dive into. We operate with a steering team, multi-agencies, and some local government reps and so forth, and there's a great interest and appetite in it, and we're very grateful to have the partnership that we do with our agency partners. I think that's where I'm going to leave off, and happy to have some questions, entertain some questions, which I'll turn over to Steve because he's the one that knows things.
Questions?
Well, I did want to mention also, Jaslyn Winkler, I want to raise your hand. She introduced herself back there. She is a high school student going to be a junior. She's interning with us for the summer, and she's going to be working on the library with Steve. So we're really pleased. She's from the Washington Technical Magnet School in St. Paul. And so we're really pleased to have her third day. So. So thank you.
Thank you. And for those of you that have ever wandered through the Department of Agriculture, you'll note that Bob Patton's office is the permanent repository. He knows where everything's at.
Yes, I do.
Yes. It's tough to work with Dave Frederickson.
Okay, can I plead the fifth?
Somebody's got to repair that table before.
Yes, I think I can do that easily.
Okay. We're all watching, Bob.
Easily, I don't know.
Right. Here, I'll
hold. You hold.
Well,
just don't use that table.
Call admin.
Yeah. Hey, this is a rental.
There's no number code on there that it stays.
I think we'll just have to
just shove it underneath.
Should we get it?
We could put a book under it.
Yeah, we could.
All right. Yeah. Thanks.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well,
another
key. They'll probably make a change.
Oh, wow.
All right. We are at the point of discussing the 2020 water plan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Eric Cedarleaf-Dahl.
And I'm Katie Pratt.
And this portion of the board meeting, we're going to talk about EQB's state water planning authorities and past planning efforts. And then we'll get into the fun part, and that's a discussion and brainstorming session on the 2020 plan. So we're kind of move quickly because the past is the past, and let's talk about the future, right? So this is our statutory authority, 103B.151. Really, we can focus on number two here. And earlier, Alan pointed out that we have a lot of water authorities, but really today we're just talking about number two, which is coordinating comprehensive long-range water resource planning every 10 years, the state water plan. And so it was published first in 91, and then in September 2000, and then 2010, and the next one is due September 15th, 2020. Okay, and so in your packets you have the watermarks, which is the 2000 plan, just kind of the executive summary of that, as well as a sheet of our statutory water authorities, if anyone is interested in those, as well as the 2010 plan. And I'm going to briefly discuss the state plans just for a little context before we discuss the 2020 water plan. Minnesota watermarks, gauging the flow of progress 2000 to 2010, was the start of the 10-year process toward unifying water management in Minnesota. It contained four statewide goals, nine objectives, and 10 indicators to help measure results. As part of this process, teams were established to determine specific goals and objectives for Minnesota's major water basins to identify common concerns. To prepare for the plan, EQB's Water Resources Committee and Water Unification Task Force were created to provide leadership for the process, to focus public discussion. The committees produced a preliminary document before we actually wrote the plan called Preparing for the Water Plan 2000, a public review draft, which contained several goals, objectives, and 29 indicators to measure results. The group, the task force and the Water Resources Committee from the EQB gathered the feedback from the public and interested stakeholders to help develop the 2000 plan. And Minnesota watermarks specifically looked at seven water basins, and those are Lake Superior, the Minnesota River, Missouri River, Des Moines River, Rainy River, Red River, Upper Mississippi, Lower Mississippi, Cedar River, and St. Croix. I just wanted to kind of give you a context of, you know, we looked at them as a basin-wide approach. And then based on reports from each of the basin teams, these sections describe the basin, the status of planning efforts, basin goals and objectives, conditions, pressure indicators, and point out particular issues of concern and discuss the next steps for each of those basins. So that was really the 2000 plan. That's really quick. If you want to spend more time with the document, it's on EQB's website as well as right here. And I think it's important as we talk about the 2020 plan and I talk about the 2010 plan to take it all in context with what Bob just presented. There's already a lot of information available in that resource. So what is the purpose of the 2020 plan, and what can we as a board and staff and state kind of look forward to. So the 2010 state water plan, most current version focused on defining a vision for Minnesota's water resources that ensures healthy ecosystems and meets the needs of future generations. And it's really comprised of three main components: reflecting on the past, which summarized key points from past decades of planning efforts and presented significant issues and events that have influenced our understanding of natural resource priorities; evaluating the status of Minnesota's water resources in the present, so what's the current status of all the water that, similar to what we just heard with the E&E report, and the state's groundwater, and what are monitoring efforts happening around the state, and then what are the trends. And then third, charting a roadmap for the future implementation principles and strategies. And so this was the foundation of the water plan and identified key strategies and principles for achieving the vision of sustainable water resource management. So the plan's goal really was to inform state agencies' programs that are responsible for addressing the multitude of water challenges facing Minnesota in 2010, and it was really in the 10-year time planning horizon. So it was 2010 to 2020. You know, what's our plan, and what are the challenges, and what should we be doing? And to communicate to the legislature, the public, and agencies, the commitment of agencies toward working towards sustainable water management. So during the development of the 2010 plan, the 2008 Legacy Act was passed by the Minnesota voters. And when the 2010 plan was published 2 years after the Legacy Act passage, the plan was not really yet able to reflect on the impact of the amendment. And really in 2020, we have that opportunity to reflect on what's happened since the Legacy Amendment. And as Bob's presentation showed, much has changed in water planning and management in Minnesota, as you all probably know. And so then one last thing before we get into the discussion. On your desks, I gave you this document it's really exciting, titled State Water Plan 16 Monographs. And it's just a draft, and I'm sorry I couldn't give it to you beforehand, but the group that's working on it, the American Water Resources Association, or AWRA, asked that I didn't put it out electronically yet until it's the final version. So you all have a draft, and what's really neat about this document is, one, EQB has been working on the Minnesota section with member agencies on the for accuracy and, you know, presenting what we did the last time and what we did in the 2015 policy report. But then it's also an overview of 16 states and how their water plans, their process, their budgets, what each of them focused on. Some are more vision documents, some are actual implementation documents. Some had $30 million to utilize, and some had $500,000. So it's been really helpful as Katie and I and the rest of the EQB staff team have discussed what should we do for the 2020 water plan, seeing what the other states have done. And I think it would be, you know, great if you all want to spend a Saturday night reading it too, because it's fun. So it's a great way to look at how Minnesota could be creative in our process and final project. And so, yeah.
Very minor, but I think telling. If you are to look at each of the covers of these plans, so far Minnesota, the only one has a person. Their last one has a...
Yeah. I didn't include all of them, but let's see. Yeah.
Water.
That's a great point.
I'm going to have that for next time. Yes.
I like that. Thanks for pointing that out. Yep, Texas didn't either. No person on theirs either. Nor Utah's got some rafters on it, so I guess they. So you know, peruse that, and we are going to continue to utilize it as well as work with the AWRA and updating it. And I'll share with you the final version of that when it's completed, and we'll be continuing to use it as we develop a planning process for 2020. So now, Katie, and I are going to walk you through some discussion questions, and hopefully we'll have a robust discussion. And if not, we can move on to the next presentation, but I'm sure we will. And,
yeah. Thanks for that context, Eric. No, this is great. So two things. I have some discussion questions up here just to jog our thinking. We don't have to go in order. I'm just curious your thoughts. And then also, Eric and I have been having informal conversations with a number of different staff just to take their temperature. You know, how could this report be useful? What is your institutional memory of the last water plan and so on? And I did kind of consolidate those ideas into a concept note, which is like a very drafty, high-level thought of what this could look like. So I can walk you through that at some point, too. But maybe before we go there, just to get some discussion started. And really, the core of this discussion is there's been so much work done on water. You know, one of the reasons we brought Bob up, if you go into the water research library and you look at, I did a quick scan of, you know, how many documents were produced in the last decade, and it was over 1,000, if I did that search correctly. So, you know, the state is producing, generating a lot of reports and literature. And so what do we do with this one that really adds value? And, you know, at a very high level, as we've been talking to staff, I think there's a general consensus among the folks we've communicated with that even though there is a lot going on water and there are a lot of reports and that reports aren't the most exciting thing to the public, there is a real opportunity with this 2020 state water plan to continue to, you know, further conversations about water in the state. And so what we have to be smart and strategic about how we, you know, do that in the best way. So just open it up from there.
We've got John Blink and then Al.
So thanks. My institutional memory on state water plans is pretty cluttered by many of them. But I would say that in the last 10 years since the last report, almost every the agency has produced all of our water quality reports on watersheds in that period of time. So it's the first time that we've, using the Clean Water Fund resources, done a watershed assessment in all of the 80 watersheds. Not all the reports are done, but we've assessed all the conditions in every watershed in that period of time. So the volume of knowledge about water quality comprehensively has grown exponentially in that 10-year period of time. And I would also want us to maybe think carefully about the Clean Water Roadmap that the agencies and EQB worked together on in 2014. Was really instrumental in shaping the governor's views on what kind of pace of progress we're making toward clean water goals as a state. So those are two kind of key things from my perspective as head of the Pollution Control Agency. We know so much more now about our water quality conditions and have influenced policy now in formal and informal ways to set sort of parameters around the pace of our progress. So I'm just sort of leaping to my own version of a conclusion, which is pace of progress is the key message. I think there's a significant level of investment in data and across many fronts, whether it's on any of our water resource conditions, but now it's really time to ask continue to ask the question, are we making progress at the pace that the state believes is appropriate? And pose that question at this level because it's interagency and interdisciplinary and includes citizen input, and I think that's a really valuable perspective.
Just to follow up on, let me just follow up on that point really quick because you mentioned the Clean Water Roadmap, and my understanding is that MPCA is doing an update to that in 2019. Also, MPCA is doing an update to the Nutrient Management Strategy in 2019, and so and I know the other, you know, all the other agencies have things going on as well. So that's another question folded into this. How do we make these efforts synergistic and not duplicative? Yeah.
If I could interrupt one second, too. just to give a little more context that I'm not sure I was clear about, and that is, you know, in 2018 here, we're still in the scoping period. And then really, we want to kind of have a solid scope. And then in 2019, you know, EQB staff and member agency staff, boots on the ground, you know, working in communities or whatever the board decides as, you know, where we want to go. Really, 2019 and the first half of 2020, because we have these 2 years to really, really work on it.
Yeah, I'm wondering how the state water plan fits in on both the local end and the federal end. I think the counties are required by state law, perhaps, to do a county water plan. And the state money is used to help fund the county water plans. How does that roll up into the state water plan? And then on the federal level, are there any federal requirements for state water plans? Is there a federal water plan? And if not, these waters flow downstream to our neighboring states to the south. I'm kind of wondering how this key fits into the
Do you want to speak to that, or
I don't know, if there's a board member that?
Yeah. Oh, Annie has a.
I can speak to the first half of that.
You want to join us up here so we can hear you on the microphone?
You probably should. We're a big
podcast. They're still recording.
Oh, they're still recording.
Welcome, Annie.
Thank you. Thanks. Members of the board. Annie Felix-Gurth with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And so at the board, my position is to help coordinate water programs. And so you spoke a little bit about the framework, I believe, is the roadmap, the framework. Is that the same thing?
No.
No, okay. So we've got a lot of different things going on. I mean, and that's been my, I've been with Bowser now for a little over a year, and it's been my pleasure to wade through all of these different activities that the different agencies do, and I spend a little bit of time thinking about this. And so just to kind of lay things out there and answer your question, counties, water planning has been going on in Minnesota about since the 1950s, when the state decided that we would allow for watershed districts to establish. And if they establish, then they are required to do plans, management plans. And then sometime in the 80s, late 80s, the legislature approved water planning at the county level, and that's a voluntary program. And then at the same time, we did metro surface water planning programs, and water management organizations were required to be established in the metro area, and they are required to do management plans. So we've got a mix of required and voluntary management programs throughout the state, but we do have entire state coverage, which is great. And then everyone knows about the most recent water planning program, which is within one watershed, one plan. And that's a watershed planning scale, and it's expected to have statewide coverage about 2025. And so those are also voluntary as well. The problem is that all these planning cycles do not coincide with all the other things that are going on. And so that's a big struggle. So when you try to stop time and then do an analysis on what's going on, they're not all doing the same thing at the same time. So that's difficult when it comes to planning. But one thing I think this plan can help do is help to organize all the different agency efforts and give a good reunified vision for what they can practicably accomplished in the next 10 years. I think that's a really difficult discussion to have, because when you actually put a time frame on it, what do we expect to accomplish in the next 10 years with all of our programs, and set a vision for that, and what can we really do with our current resources? That's a really great discussion. It would help people like me understand, well, what are we shooting for when we look at all the watersheds that are going to be, you know, revising their plans in the next 10 years. So I don't know if that helps answer your question, but we are in Minnesota far more advanced than a lot of the other states in the nation as far as planning. We're probably the premier state.
Al, your question is, do the local plans roll up into something? The answer to that is no.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like chaos to me.
No, it's not. It's just based on what you're required or volunteer to do. So Bowser can tell you who's got what local plans, but they're not, they don't roll up. In the old days, in the 70s, there was Basin Commission. So we had a Southern Minnesota River Basin Commission. You had the Mississippi River Basin Commission. You had the Red River Basin Commission. All of those were intended at one point in time. If you talk to folks like me that were actually working in the 70s, they were all going to roll up into a, you know, series of basin plans funded in part by USDA's, you know, money, USGS's money. Feds were putting a lot of money into basin commissions in those days. That stopped during the Reagan administration. And then we now have this, what appears to be a patchwork of chaos. But the goals are locally driven, so this is, I think, the debatable point. Should the state set higher goals for those local plans to aim for? That's always been the debate. Or do you value local control and local goals over state goals?
Or a model that where you have nested goals.
Right.
Where you have state overriding goals, and then as you get to smaller watersheds, there may be problems or opportunities that are unique to that small unit, where they would have their own goals, but they would all nest into one statewide plan.
Nobody will love either of those ideas. I guarantee it. I mean, that's my perspective, that we've suggested that over time, that there would be harmony, greater harmony, if you adopted that mindset. But it other people characterize it as presuming the goal-setting responsibility for local people. And the board has taken lots of testimony over the years on this about the value of local control. And they have been pretty adamant that watershed planning and watershed goal setting, even basin planning and basin goal setting, is not the job of state or federal government. They believe, I'm not saying the board, but the board's taken a lot of testimony. My reflection on it is, I think if we asked again, and the plan could ask that question again, people will come to the same answer, which is, we prefer local control. Because there are some high-level goals in statute already. Flood damage reduction goals, drought and water conservation goals. There are goals around clean water. But there are, whether they should rise up to a higher-level plan, I think you'll get some pushback. I'm fine having this board go out and take testimony on that, because it'll draw a lot of interesting flack from the communities. And I, you know, frankly, that's good discussion to have.
Well, I think it's a question that should be asked.
Mr. Chair.
I don't think, I'm a strong mobile advocate, obviously. Yeah. But I don't see it as usurping the local authority when it's a nested system and the local unit still has the opportunity to have their own goals. And that these overriding goals shouldn't be controversial. If water goes downstream, it affects all those folks. So they're going to be higher water quality, fishable, swimmable.
I know there's comments, but just to tag into this line of thinking, one of the ideas that has been floated among staff as a possible model for the 2020 water plan is to use the 2020 water plan as really a platform to foreground watershed scale efforts, and basically featuring going watershed by watershed and hitting every watershed across the state and trying to build relationships with water leaders in every watershed and kind of bringing their voices into the point. So it's effectively kind of a ground up type of approach. So that's one model.
Jessica. I have no history with water plans, so this is just sort of a fundamental baseline question, which is, as I'm looking at the two plans that you've provided us from 2010, this is very much like the strategic planning exercise that we've been through. There are very high-level goals. There aren't numbers associated with it. It's like increased water quality and those kinds of things. So my question for the team and the board and the audience is, are we envisioning something more substantive as for the 2020 plan? I think we are, and I ask that in a way that I think we are better prepared and better set up to do that than we have ever been before based on the work that's been done. And so that's one sort of question to throw out to the group. But the other question that I would, or suggestion that I would have, is let's not reinvent the wheel in one more planning exercise. And I hearken back to the first presentation we got today, which is we've been doing this great report card work. We've been identifying what some goals are and what progress we're making. And we've also, you know, included in that, in one of your questions is who's the audience for this report. We've put into the report card work that we've done very accessible, straightforward suggestions about, you know, don't flush the toilet as much or whatever, you know, whatever it is about how we can address water. And I think using some of the really great work that the EQB has been doing in the last several years, as well as what all of the rest of the agencies have been doing, not reinventing that, but again, taking that all, compiling that, and making that what our planning is toward the future. So two different kind of ideas about how specific are we going to be, and then also how do we use the work that we've already been doing and really use this opportunity to compile that in a curated way.
You know, a real pure plan looks for goals and outcomes. It looks for the lofty things you want to get to. And in some cases, that works when the goals and the outcomes are in the purview of the entity developing the plan. In this case, if we were to set goals, lofty goals, say 50% you know, impairment instead of 40% impairment or 60% impairment, it's just us in the room. It doesn't get to this notion that we have local units of government doing the water plans and doing the water implementation and so on. And so that notion of setting forth the desired outcome is really challenging, because ultimately what it comes back to is, well, what do you have available to give me to help me get to those goals? And so a good planner will tell you, do your plan based on what you want out of it, not what you're going to put into it. But I think that at this point in time, we sort of have to reverse it. I say at this point in time, we're 8 years into the, or 10 years into the legacy amendment, we've got 12 years, 15 years left. By the time this plan would be done, you'd have 14 years left. And yet we have never had the discussion that if we have $2.5 billion to spend on water from the Clean Water Fund, that's $100 million a year for 25 years, how would you most effectively allocate that money among all of the activities we do for monitoring, for assessment, for implementation, for everything else? We've never had that discussion, and so we are proceeding along year after year, taking last year's budget, dusting it off, and putting forward next year's budget. And at the end of 25 years, we will have spent that money. But we need to think about, in 2034, looking back, did we spend it the way we think we should have? And I would offer, perhaps, this is the opportunity to stand in 2034 and say, okay, we got $2.5 billion. Here's the situation we've got. How would we allocate that $2.5 billion? And among those efforts that are identified in the Constitution, protect, enhance, restore, among those efforts, how much should we spend to protect? 100 million, 500 million, a billion? Nobody's ever answered or asked that question. And so I think it'd be appropriate to stand back and ask that question at this point in time, because we still have some time left to spend, money left to spend. But then even go a little bit deeper and say, okay, if restoration becomes a priority, okay, then how much do we spend, and where do we spend it? Do we spend it on the most degraded waters? Or do we spend it those that are on the bubble and try and push them over? Do we spend it in areas where it's going to be extraordinarily expensive on a per acre basis or whatever? So it seems to me we have an opportunity at this point in time to think about having that discussion that'll bring in, you know, broad participation about where do we want to spend the rest of this $1.5 billion that we're going to have, because we're only going to spend it. Well, we will spend it, but we want to make sure that as we plan our budgeting, as we think about the future, we spend it in a way that will get us most effectively towards the goals that we want to, the things that we think are important.
Other comments or questions? Comments? Kristen? Oh, and then, I'm sorry, Matt.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm really interested in the progress that's been made on the watershed data that you're talking about. And I wish I already knew this, but who's in charge of One Watershed, One Plan? Bowser? Okay. I find that, as you know, a local government participant, you know, really a place that I could stretch and identify with. I mean, that I'm ready to stretch and identify with. And I heard some discussions a number of years ago at the legislature when this was being discussed, when the committees were discussing it. And I really like that framework. I like to somehow see us reinforce that framework, and it's a potential, you know, nesting. So I guess that is my main. I had one more point, but I can't remember what it is. Thanks.
I guess one thing that I would encourage to think about in, you know, much like we, the state water plan is obviously this big comprehensive policy-based Rubik's Cube of a project. Many of you know that on a state government kind of operations level, we've been doing some work to try and ask the question of, just like with company A and B and C, are you acting good, or citizen A, B, and C, are you acting appropriately and doing the things you could do, that we're trying to make sure we do that in state government. And so I think it would be helpful to tie those two efforts, even if it's just a text box somewhere in the report that uses the state as an example of whether or not we are or are not leading by example when it comes to water behavior.
Ellen?
Just one quick thing following up on what Tom was saying. If we were a private business and our product was improved water quality, we would do a business plan to figure out what's the best way to invest our money to maximize that improved water quality. And maybe that's what a water quality plan is for us, or at least a portion of it. Hmm.
And I just remembered my other point. I was at the first water summit, and I was in some work groups listening sessions, and heard a lot of discussion about investing in protection, and how much cheaper it is to, you know, that's a priority, at least in this group. It was a really interesting discussion, and I just wanted to reflect that back, because that was really the conclusion of that public discussion, is that protection is cheap and it should be high on the priority list.
Talk a little bit about the one watershed, one plan, because my watershed is in that process right now, and it is. I think it's kind of like the nested plan you talk about in a way, because the Board of Water and Soil Resources has identified some things that they want to see in these plans, but the plans are largely local. We sit down with many, many different groups, committees. It's really quite a process to go through this. But the idea is to come up with implementable goals that, you know, we can be carried out, with the idea, furthermore, that there's going to be money to carry out these goals down the road. And in fact, that just started this last year, where money has now been identified to support those one watershed, one plans that have been finished. We haven't got very many finished yet, but we're in the process. So I agree with John in that if this was not local, there would be an uproar. Because right now, one of the fears that I hear from counties when we talk about one watershed, one plan, is, well, they're going to take it out of our hands. You know, they're going to tell us what the goals are. And we're not, that's not the case. That's not the case, and that's something we have to overcome, is that thought. But I think it's a really good start, and I guess I'm proud of Minnesota for what we're doing at this point. I think we're far ahead of many other places.
Thanks, Jerry. Other comments or questions?
Just one follow-up to kind of make sure that, if you're not familiar with water planning, it's been very consistent throughout the decades in the process that we follow. And maybe this gets somewhat to your point, is that early on in the process, when we convene the stakeholders and we announce that we're starting the planning effort, we send out a call to all the state agencies asking for, and when I say we, I'm acting as the local government unit that's starting the effort, will send out requests for priority concerns from all the state agencies. And this is the opportunity then that the state agencies have to provide input on what they believe is important for that watershed. So it's a bridge of, you know, state government and what they think is important for that particular watershed or that area that we're talking about. They submit those to the locals. So locals then add in their own priority concerns in discussion or whatever process they use to gather that. And then so it's all in the mix, right? And they may or may not decide to choose some of those priority concerns that were offered by the state agencies, but in most cases they do. And so that's what's great about Minnesota Water Planning is it is a combination of the state agencies providing the best input and the best expertise, in my opinion, to about the resource to the locals, and then they apply this values filter about what they think is important for their community. And that's the great unification between the two groups, I think.
Just to follow up, I think it kind of ties a few of these things together. So we talked about the roadmap. You know, I've envisioned the roadmap as sort of the top of the cone of the nested cups that Al talked about. It's the top of the cone. It says if we spend all this money over 25 years, here's where we're going to end up. I view those one watershed, one plans as the sort of bottom cups. And what belongs in the middle are those plans or those goals that tie together that top and that bottom. And I think there are three of those cups, and I think we've got one. I think the three cups are point source pollution, non-point source pollution, and groundwater. That's the way I frame it up in my mind. And I think we've got the point source pollution cup in place. That's been in place since the Clean Water Act, and that is in place. What we're missing, I think, in Minnesota is a notion for how do we implement water quality goals for groundwater, and how do we implement water quality goals for surface water? And I think that's the part that's missing. It's the part that ties that big picture Minnesota's water quality vision together with those one watershed, one plan things. And it seems to me that could be, part of that is just how do we allocate the Clean Water Fund. So it could be part, which we'll get to both groundwater and surface water. But it seems to me that could be the bite that we try to capture in this kind of a plan.
I just want to offer a little, this is great, this is helpful, and there's, you know, a few different ideas on the table. You know, I'm hearing kind of this maximizing our investment approach. I'm hearing about this kind of nested approach where we're trying to, you know, really articulate this nexus between local watershed planning and state government planning. But I want to put a third idea on the table, and this is kind of what I wrote up that came out of some conversations with staff. And this is another notion that actually there's quite a bit of planning fatigue in the state, that we planned ourselves to death. And do we really need another plan? And so this approach would maybe de-emphasize the sort of, you know, traditional planning aspects of the 2020 water plan and ratchet up the engagement part and sort of a multimedia approach to this. And so based on a few different conversations, one idea was to actually produce a film, find some resources and some partners to produce a little documentary about what we do with water in the state. There's a lot of citizens out there that have no idea that water is an issue in the state. They have no idea who does anything with water, and to help tell that really unique story that we have as Minnesota, as a state, and then to take this film out on the road and talk to people and have them tell their stories about, you know, water, you know, quote unquote planning, their experience with water management or protection, whether it's in their backyard or their community or in their professional pursuits or what have you, and then still produce, you know, maybe a short and sweet kind of, you know, document that gives actionable items that we'll be looking to do over the next 10 years. So that's just a different model to consider. And I think all of these have pros and cons, and we'll, you know, really be looking for your guidance and your thinking on this as we continue to scope over the next few months. And, you know, please send us any brilliant ideas that you have as we make our way through this.
I'm fresh out. You're fresh out of
yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I have a couple of thoughts for the plan, and one is looking at what the audience is and thinking back to last summer, the 25x25 community mm-hmm. conversations or whatever they were. I think those people are going to have some high expectations mm-hmm. For what's going to come out of 25x25, and I'm guessing this might be the first.
It can definitely tie too, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's one thought. The other is definitely the importance of involving input from the Native American community mm-hmm. who have, you know, of course, a deep abiding connection to water, but also have treaty rights mm-hmm. that we should involve them in any planning we do.
Mm-hmm.
Other comments or questions? Good discussion. Al and then Kristen.
just following up on my earlier question, does this need to fit into a federal process or federal permit, federal plan?
No.
Can you articulate a federal plan as it relates to water? I can't right off the top of my head. In terms of water management, possibly, as it relates to major tributaries, but in terms of, I don't think they want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
The federal permitting level, the water, Corps of Engineers permit, and the Coast Guard permits are major deals. But maybe there's no nexus between state plan. I'm just asking a question.
I've spent the last 7.5 years as the governor's representative of the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association. And of course, we work, the basin works hand in hand with the Corps of Engineers. They can't lobby, the five governors can, and to encourage some action at the federal level. But I think from a water quality perspective, I would think that it would be much easier for local communities to come together. I mean, it's either fix the problem or don't fix the problem, but from a water management perspective, what's good for Hannibal, Missouri may not be good further down the line in terms of levees. And so they want to control the height of levees. And I don't know where the best plan would be in terms of water management, particularly on the Upper Miss.
Yeah, there was a huge hassle about the water that and that's maybe a statewide planning issue. I always felt that the simplest way to identify the water in the United States would be to put it on a map, like the public waters map, rather than have this elaborate, totally confounding process on how to define a point for water in the United States.
I'm with you, Al. I just said that to a bunch of people in Nebraska.
Let's go with Julie. You represent a major watershed in the state.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Katie. All the plans you've been doing, everybody's sick of planning, but we are working on a plan right now, thanks to the PCA. But it's where we bring in North Dakota, Manitoba, a little bit of South Dakota, so all of these planning activities that take place are very good for us, because what we do is compile the information and we come up with a Red River Basin recommendation. So, because a lot of people will say, oh, it's just targeted toward the Twin Cities or southern Minnesota or whatever. So the more plans, the pollinator plan, Minnesota has everything. North Dakota, a little bit, they have some, but they don't have as many agencies or as much money right now until they have oil. But they, and then they give money to do the planning. But I'm just saying I like all these plans, and we take all the information and we compile it, and it's really useful for us in a basin that's kind of out there by itself. So
that's great perspective. Yeah.
Thanks.
Kristen, then we'll move on to item 8.
I just want to say that water planning gives us a really unique opportunity to look at health of people and the communities, the natural communities. And I was just at a presentation last night that showed in Africa where people were having to choose between keeping their wild creatures in the area alive and their families. I think this. There also, I'm really interested in your story approach, because I think one of the major human technologies is story, and we shouldn't forget how, if you're going to be traveling around with stories, how powerful good examples are for people to engage and follow. I just want to emphasize that part of it, of what they're doing. So that's it. Thanks.
Good. Let's move on to item 8.
Thank you.
And ask,
got it all figured out.
Nita? Nita Anderson with the Minnesota Department of Health. Just find your way to the two tables that don't fall down. That's good. So welcome, Nita, to be.
Thank you, Chair, board members, and staff. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you today about an effort to advance safe and sustainable water reuse in Minnesota, and how we'd like to move some recommendations forward. And I'm from the Minnesota Department of Health, but I am here representing a larger agency work group, which I'll talk more about in a bit. So I'll just start with some background on water reuse, describe our interagency effort, and then again how we'd like to move recommendations forward, and we might be asking for some advice from all of you. So I just like to make sure everybody's on the same page with what is water reuse before I go further. So kind of traditionally, water reuse was thought of as the reuse of reclaimed municipal wastewater, primarily for non-drinking water uses like irrigation or flushing toilets. But really the scope of this water reuse has broadened over the years and recently. So as a work group, we defined water reuse as the capture and use of stormwater, wastewater, and subsurface water to meet water demands for intentional and beneficial uses. So just to dig into that a little bit, you can see our graphic on the right kind of describes some of these sources. So rainwater is a subset of stormwater, rainwater being collected only off of roof surfaces. Stormwater can be collected also off of land surfaces. Gray water and industrial and commercial waters, those are subsets of wastewater. So gray water comes typically only from sinks, showers, and laundry, whereas wastewater will also include kitchens and toilets, or could include non-domestic wastewater, again, such as industrial, commercial. So we have a variety of source waters. We aren't really considering things like, we know that St. Cloud discharges their wastewater into the Mississippi, and Minneapolis subsequently draws out for drinking water. That's what we call de facto reuse. But we do have a lot of dilution and such going on there. And really, water reuse is more thought of as things where we're shortening the natural cycle, where we might be going at some point directly from a wastewater plant, almost right into the drinking water plant, or some other situation like that. And so we're looking at anything, again, primarily at, right now, looking at non-potable uses like, did you have a question right away?
What's subsurface?
So what we meant by that mostly is like foundation water, so kind of near subsurface, but what we're calling nuisance water that we're managing in some way because we don't want it around our buildings, but, you know, so not necessarily talking our deeper well water there. So again, we're primarily focused on non-drinking water uses, but are also considering the drinking water, whether it be direct or whether it might be more that we want to clean these waters to some degree and inject them back into our aquifers, either to replenish it or to reuse it subsequently. So we kind of have a lot of definitions around this, but really what I want to keep in mind is that we're really looking at what is the quality of whatever water we're considering using. What's the availability of that water, and you know, is it in the right place for where we want to be reusing it? So water reuse is currently happening in Minnesota. I mentioned kind of the traditional reuse is wastewater for non-potable uses such as irrigation, and we've had guidance on the books for that type of reuse for over 40 years, and we have about over 40 systems doing that right now. Again, mostly for irrigation. We have one supplying a power plant and one for toilet flushing. And those are permitted by PCA. But the stormwater and rainwater systems, they're really a growing interest right now. And they don't always have to be permitted. So if they're not falling under the plumbing code, they may not need a permit. And so our numbers are estimated for those systems, but we know we have at least 100 of these sorts of systems at a commercial scale. And we're seeing more interest in some of these other uses like our sources like gray water. And the reason it's happening is because we see benefits to it. So we've heard a lot today, and you all know about our desire to conserve our water, to protect our pristine groundwater sources, to replenish them where we have seen those levels falling. We're interested in improving our water quality. One way to do that is through better stormwater management. Of course, we want to maintain good resources for economic reasons, and we're also looking at those potential energy and infrastructure savings. So that's why it's happening. And it's, you know, being successful in Minnesota, but we were also still getting some questions. So some people were hitting some roadblocks. And, for example, we had housing developments saying, well, we'd like to pipe water from our stormwater pond into the development kind of as a second water source for them to irrigate their lawns. But do we need to worry about water quality, and what does it need to be? Our newest state park, Vermilion State Park, wanted to reuse gray water, and they were asking, you know, why do we need a variance from the plumbing board, and how do we do this? Golden Plump chicken plant in Cold Spring, they already do a lot of water recycling, but they wanted to take it to the next level where they would treat their processed water back to drinking water quality so that they could do their final rinse with that, but that wasn't allowed under USDA regulations, so they asked the health department for the, you know, for our opinion on it. And then we were hearing a lot from golf courses who wanted to do more sustainable practices, whether it was recycling their water to wash golf carts or, again, for irrigation. So we were getting these questions, and so we said, well, who should we be directing these questions to? So we have a number of agencies that work with water in our state. We could say we have a bit of our regulatory soup. And, you know, but soup is a good thing. It's nutritious and tasty. But we want to make sure that each of our agencies is contributing, you know, their ingredient to that soup. So we kind of try to get down to one word, what each agency does related to water reuse. You know, Department of Labor and Industry would be involved with plumbing, DNR conservation, MDA agriculture, MDH health, PCA environment, and Bowser local planning and implementation. But, you know, our current regulations really weren't written with water reuse in mind. So it wasn't always easy for us to share that roadmap, and we really wanted to be able to share our soup recipe with everyone. So we started to dig into that a little bit more. And I'll also just mention some other efforts that really called for agencies to work on this. The 2015 EQB report called for state agencies to update plumbing codes and treatment standards to allow for safe and practical water reuse. The sustainability framework that guides the Clean Water Fund called, again, for agencies to plan for water reuse, including identifying and evaluating water reuse strategies and applications, and particularly called for PCA and MDH to work together to set appropriate standards for water reuse applications. And also, we adopted a new plumbing code in Minnesota in 2015, and that included some chapters on rainwater harvesting and some alternate sources of water. So they were also looking to see what needed to be done to move forward with reuse. And really, when we consider the agency role, a decent part of that role is to manage any risks that might be associated with this practice. So if we're changing the way we're discharging our wastewater, you know, are there considerations to the environment? Are we changing the exposures either to animals, plants, et cetera, with those changes in management? Are there any human health concerns? Again, we haven't, you know, there's just no standards right now for non-drinking water purposes, so, but there's still exposure there. So how do we deal with those, any biological or chemical or even physical hazards with that? And, you know, is this water reuse a passing trend, or is this something that we want long into the future? We're talking about planning. You know, how is this going to impact our systems? We know that, you know, conservation efforts are great, but they do impact the utilities. They reduce revenue to the utilities. If we're changing the quality of the wastewater, that's going to impact operations. So we want to make sure that we're, you know, doing systems that are going to be successfully implemented far into the future to protect our investment. So in kind of response to these charges, to these questions, there have been some movement around water reuse. Back in 2011, the Met Council did a stormwater reuse manual. And then the MPCA in 2016 was updating their stormwater manual, included an updated section on harvesting and use of stormwater. The Freshwater Society has been involved. They are very interested in this and have been promoting it and kind of getting workshops together to talk about the issues. Again, we tried to, as MDH, needed to answer some of these health risk questions, so we partnered with the University of Minnesota to get some additional data and do some of that research on health effects. And we've also been participating in some national efforts. So there are other states that either are ahead of us or have the same questions as us. So we wanted to partner nationally to do that collaboration. But we kind of saw at some point that we really needed, so a lot of this work was kind of ad hoc work or, you know, work that we were finding ways to do, but we saw we needed a more supported, concerted effort. And so we requested some Clean Water Fund money and received that back in 2016. And the goal of that project was to prepare a comprehensive study of and make recommendations for both regulatory and non-regulatory approaches to water reuse for use in the development of state policy for water reuse in Minnesota. So that's a little bit wordy, but what we were really trying to do was answer some of these questions, get a starting point to really continue the conversation and try to move this forward. So MDH was the lead agency on this project. It was a 2-year time frame. And part of our money went to this interagency work group, so each agency got some of that funding to provide staff for that work group, and then some, again, went to our research project with the University of Minnesota. And kind of why we were the lead for this was because we felt things were a little bit stalled out on that water quality risk question. And so over that 2-year time frame, we had 19 work group meetings, again, with those 6 Minnesota state agencies, along with the Met Council and the University of Minnesota. We also had stakeholder meetings. We realized state agencies aren't the only ones involved. We did feel it was worthwhile to start at that state agency level. That was kind of enough to wrangle with to start with, but we will have local partners, et cetera, going on forward, and we certainly wanted their input into this process. And we released a final report in March of 2018. So just to go over briefly what's in the report, if you haven't had any time to look at it, we did provide some information about water reuse in Minnesota, some examples of what's going on, how they're currently managed, some of the challenges and opportunities associated with these systems. We also did look at, again, policies and management in other states and nations. We definitely heard that we don't want to reinvent the wheel, that there are other people that are ahead of us in this, and so we wanted to learn from them. We looked at ways to manage human health risks posed by water reuse. We included the stakeholder input, including some survey results and summaries from our meetings, as well as just incorporating that feedback into our recommendations. And we are putting forward 8 recommendations. So I will be going through each of these individually briefly, but so I won't talk about them all right now, but just to say that we laid out these 8 recommendations, we proposed an approximate timeline for implementing these and tried to outline, you know, which recommendations might be dependent on each other. So this is kind of the big picture. And really what we're looking for, again, to, you know, how do we move these recommendations forward is who's going to take the lead from here? It could be possible for MDH to maintain the lead, or are we better positioned to focus on the health information and working with utilities? We will be publishing a white paper on water criteria that was felt it was too detailed for this report, but we are working on that currently, and we're continuing to partner with the University of Minnesota on research projects for necessary data. Or should, it's been proposed, maybe DNR should lead, because really a big reason we're looking at reuse is for those conservation efforts. Or PCA, since, you know, this is, a lot of this is happening in the wastewater and stormwater arena, and that's their line of business. Or perhaps EQB might want to coordinate a team of agencies to take the lead going forward. Or I mentioned the Freshwater Society or the university. So this is kind of what we're asking you to think about if you can as we talk about these recommendations. So our first recommendation was to create an expanded work group with practitioners, advisors, and stakeholders. And basically that's, you know, we still need that oversight, a big group. Certainly we haven't tapped out all the expertise in this area, and so we wanted to create this expanded work group that would include multiple levels and maximize that expertise and provide general oversight and coordination. I mentioned we already have some research underway, but we wanted to put someone in charge of prioritizing research needs and integrating that ongoing research as we move forward. And again, we want to build on national efforts and efforts already underway. So perhaps, you know, the expanded work group is kind of the overarching entity. Perhaps there's subgroups that would lead each of these additional recommendations, and maybe the university would be the one to lead this. Our third recommendation was to define roles and responsibilities. Again, our report was kind of focused on the state agency level. At this point, we do feel like that, again, clarity and consistency at the state level is a place to start. And so we proposed one scenario for those state agency roles. And now the next steps would be to assess the feasibility of that and, again, examine other structures for how to define those roles. Of course, we would need resources as well as agency support and political will to move forward with this. I kind of mentioned, again, wanting to be able to share the recipe for water reuse, and this is where we would have a central repository, so kind of our one-stop shop. So even if there's going to be multiple entities involved, we want to have that one entry point that would then guide people to where they need to go from there. A couple kind of examples of similar situations might be the Minnesota Business First Stop or the Office of Enterprise Sustainability that are also multi-agency efforts that help guide people. Recommendation E, to develop a risk-based management system. So I mentioned we looked at both regulatory and non-regulatory approaches. I think everybody wants to avoid more rules when we can, but if there are risks that we need to manage, we might need those regulations. So we wanted to look at, you know, where is regulation or guidance needed? And factors that'll go into that assessment are going to be, you know, again, what are the contaminant concentrations in the source water? What's the number of people or environment likely to be exposed to that contaminant? And also just the complexity of the system. How likely are we to see any failures along the way? So again, we proposed some ideas in the report on how to fit some of the applications we're seeing into these categories. Trying to answer the water quality criteria question. So we recommend this log reduction target approach for pathogens. And again, that's a little wordy that I won't go into detail on right now, but the important points to note is that this approach is flexible, it's not prescriptive, it's fit for purpose, it gives people a lot of options to get from point A to point B. So that's why we're recommending it. And really the exciting thing here is that, you know, 5 years ago we didn't have the answer to this water quality criteria question, but thanks to these national efforts, they enlisted an expert panel to do the risk assessment on these non-potable applications. We have a great starting point now that's based on good research, and we've also developed in-house expertise with our risk assessor so that we can keep plugging in new Minnesota data as it comes in and kind of make things specific to our needs and our applications. Recommendation G was to resolve unique issues related to gray water reuse. So I kind of mentioned there's not a ton of gray water reuse going on in Minnesota right now. A lot of other states are starting these laundry to landscape situations. So that sounds very simple, useful, but it's kind of like, well, does that make sense in Minnesota when, you know, things are frozen for 6 months of the year? And it's also was in conflict with current septic regulations. So we we said we do want to reuse more gray water, but there's some additional steps that need to be taken there. And then lastly, to provide education and training, so we kind of know with all our support systems, we need to be able to train the designers, the operators, the users of these systems, so to make that successful. So really kind of where we are with these recommendations and what they're trying to do is, you know, come to this balance. I've talked about the benefits to water reuse. I've talked about that we've seen some risk to it. And so now we really need to come together and do the risk management piece, balance risks and benefits and other factors. And some of those questions might be, you know, digging in a little bit more to, you know, is reuse more beneficial than our standard practices now? Or are we willing to accept maybe some more risk because the benefits are so great? And kind of round out both ends. You know, we have people that are like, well, we shouldn't give any weight to the risk because there are so many benefits. Or the people that are like, we've worked so hard to separate drinking water and wastewater. We don't want to be mixing the two. But we can come together in the middle and implement this safely, successfully, sustainably for the long term. But we need to continue that conversation. So kind of what we're looking for right now is someone to fly this plane and kind of manage all the different parts of it. That might be, of course, we'll need some funding and resources to do that. We may need changes to agency authorities. We might need rule revisions. We want to involve the public more. We haven't really involved the public in our stakeholder process, so that's another piece. And of course, we want this effort to tie into all these other great things going on with water in the state. So where we are right now is we're kind of going out, continuing to meet with small groups of stakeholders to discuss what's in the report. And people can sign up for Gov Delivery to indicate their interest in possibly being part of this work group going into the future. But we would really appreciate any thoughts, advice on kind of leadership and going forward, whether that's giving us advice today or after today. But we appreciate your time here, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Anita, for a very thorough report. Appreciate it. Questions? Comments?
I have a question. Actually, can you go all the way back kind of to one of your beginning slides where you showed the two graphs that should right there? So the graph on the right where reuse is, irrigation, I get that, but one of the things that comes to mind immediately is the complications of plumbing, both household, industrial, and the urban, just how the systems are configured and the complications that that presents for implementing water reuse. So I'm curious how, for things like vehicle washing, industrial reuse, and toilet flushing, it's coming about. Is it coming about mostly through new construction? Is that how that's been arising?
Yeah. So, yeah, you do. That's, like you say, why irrigation is maybe most popular in some ways, because it is kind of a separate system and can be.
If that's the case, it seems like, in addition to all of this regulatory, the health and safety and other things that need to be figured out, is it good or is it not good to reuse? One can kind of take that and start predicting who's going to be able to afford to do this and who's going to be able to retrofit to do this, and then who's going to be stuck on the old traditional water supply systems and how that's going to impact rates.
Right.
And I'm wondering how that all ties back to, can we forecast what we need to plan for in terms of water rate structures so that we don't get at some point caught in a place where people who are lower income, et cetera, are feeling the rate burden of a very sensible reuse effort in Minnesota.
Yeah, those are all great points. And, there's some places where reuse is going to save money and some definitely where it's going to cost more. And yeah, right now it's primarily being done by people who are really interested and have some extra source of funding.
Yeah, unless you're that and unless you're super passionate, I doubt if it's going to be cost effective for most individual homeowners, that sort of thing. And so,
yeah, it might be driven by, again, places where, I mean, we saw, obviously, there's different places in the state that are more short on water,
right,
or that might have a particular water quality issue that make this more feasible.
John?
I'm really interested in your last recommendation, so if you can go to that slide. So I'm interested in the last point, chapter of the Water Reuse Association. I want to know what that is. I think this is driven by something that emerges rather than is imposed. Mm-hmm. So I personally would rather see resources go to like the university's technical assistance program, MNTAP, other kinds of grow the industrial and opportunity side of this. From a benefit to the user rather than sort of imposed because the government says it's necessary. I think if that reuse opportunity emerges as a market and a sort of a need that comes from people who use water, then the government will match the progress. If the government tries to lead and pulls, it rarely succeed because someone's worried about agendas. So I actually like that recommendation the most. I would put more energy into that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I would just say, really, our project, I feel like, has been driven from that there were people out there doing reuse, and they had questions, and they were hitting roadblocks. And as agencies, we were trying to respond to that call. And whether it's the chapter of the Reuse Association, but there's definitely kind of been a consensus that we want to build a group. You know, we've been incorporating reuse into our wastewater operators and our drinking water agendas and so on, but to kind of have this place for this reuse community to get together and talk things through.
Electric vehicles has come, largely through user interest and demand. I just favor that sort of development on that side faster from how we can support that.
And I'll just want to mention another kind of building on the national efforts that have been going on, that's a current research project underway, is how to implement these systems and kind of call out some of the common problems and how to solve them while meeting the safety and other concerns.
Jen?
Just want to thank you. Thank the interagency group and you, Anita, for the presentation and for the work. Seems like a really good demonstration of the interagency collaboration and really wonderful points about kind of the practicality. I love your right going right to, Matt, we had to our earlier discussion today, through an equity lens, what could be the unintended consequences, or how do we design that kind of awareness in it. And John, your point about to the degree this can be demand driven, all the better. And there still will be a need to coordinate, how the agencies respond to emerging issues. So I get it that it's all going to come down to kind of resources and already full workloads. But it sure seems like a great role for EQB to have in kind of continuing a coordination role. I gather this didn't come through EQB originally. Is that right? It came directly from the legislature to the interagency group. So I think it's sure worth discussing if this isn't a good role for EQB.
It is. Thank you. Alan?
Yeah, a couple of things. And thinking of the demand, I understand that the new Saints baseball stadium uses great water as irrigation.
Target Field, too.
Rainwater.
In Mankato, yeah. The wastewater plant is being used by Calpine as cooling water in their power plant. So if we facilitate that where it makes economic sense, I think it will grow.
Yeah.
And rather than being a burden on society, it's a benefit. But one thing I've wondered with this is there's a strong regulatory movement to infiltrate water, stormwater, rather than allow it to run off.
So through ponds, holding ponds, and the water is infiltrating, but yet it's somewhat contaminated. The sediment that accumulates is considered contaminated and has to be dealt with as hazardous material. In other places, sand trenches are being built to infiltrate in order to meet the stormwater discharge permit. And that's water running off from fields, running off from roads, salt, contaminants. Are we giving any attention to, in effect, that's reuse of that water, but without any control on it? Is that being considered?
Yeah, there certainly is, you know, existing guidance on the stormwater infiltration and ongoing research and efforts into that. And, you know, in this reuse is, you know, seen by stormwater managers as an additional tool where infiltration doesn't make sense and or where it can be a, you know, where it doesn't work with the existing soils and such.
And it can be a threat to source water, too. If it's a threat to source water for drinking water systems, then you're right, Al. There's too great a risk to, you know, there's metals, there's a range of contaminants in stormwater runoff that we do not want introduced into source water capture zones, for example. And that just, so we try to address that in our guidance on stormwater management.
Matt? The other thing I would just add is once again, from the perspective of the practical application of this and learning lessons as we go along, we'll reach out to you, but also feel free to try to hold agencies like admin accountable when the state's doing its own construction projects, right? That we can be deploying these lessons and reuse. We are required to do a lot of that through the B3 guidelines anyhow. But that still sometimes can be the thing that falls off the table if there's not enough resources, and those are significant opportunities if we're doing major work at a state prison or major work at a, you know, other institutions that we can deploy some of these new lessons.
Yeah, thank you.
And collect data from them potentially if that's helpful to learn from.
Definitely.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Let's go to our second to the last item on the agenda, second only to public comment. And I'd like to ask Frank to come on up and also Peter. And we'll spend some time talking about nutrient reduction and climate protection.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. And again, for those of you who don't instantly recognize me, that's surprising, I know. But my name is Frank Kolash. I'm manager of the air assessment section for the Pollution Control Agency. Within my section, we are primarily responsible for assembling the greenhouse gas emission inventory that is required under state statute to track progress for the Next Generation Energy Act goals within the state. And the title of the presentation is Nutrient Reduction, Good for Water Quality and Climate Protection. And I think some of you have seen this presentation before, but we want to make sure we get it out to as many people to see this on multiple occasions. And I want to emphasize that the point of this presentation is to discuss with you the co-benefits that reducing nutrients going into surface water and groundwater provide for Minnesota and the climate, not under the lens of we should be doing this because of climate reduction practices. It's the co-benefits of the good added goodness to the good work we're already doing for nutrient reduction.
All good. It's all good. DCA, good.
Good
plus good.
We have a little order here. So, four
letters. I think we have this first slide here is just to frame the context that climate change is being experienced in Minnesota and the extreme cold. While that statement perhaps does not feel to be relevant in this particular year, I think all the climatologists will tell you we're cycling between extremes. And so we were seeing some things this year that were well out on the edges of what we would normally expect, but we are typically seeing a decline in the severity and frequency of of extreme cold, extreme rainfall, that it's becoming larger and more frequent. And that has a particular role to play with nutrients and with the role that they're playing with the climate protection, because that means more water going onto the land, more opportunity for these nutrients to be washed away through the soil and into the surface water, and then be put into places where they're not providing the agricultural benefits, but then affecting the climate and the emission reductions. And then heavy snowfalls, where it's less, more frequent just on the heavy snowfalls rather than the continuous ones. But the short story with this one is we are seeing the effects of climate change in Minnesota, and this underpins quite a bit of the work in the statements both from the governor and from the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce and other agencies of why it's important for Minnesota to continue to seek greenhouse gas emission reductions and also plan for climate adaptation within the state. This slide shows two summary charts that come out of our greenhouse gas emission inventory report that we do every 2 years. The next one will be produced in January of 2019. So we are updating these numbers now. The one on the left in the more the monochrome, the tan, the gray, and the light tan shows aggregate emissions through 2014, which is the most recent emissions data that we have. And then the light tan taupe colored shows just a straight line projection of where we would have to be for the 2015 goal and the 2025 goal. So the takeaway from the graph on the left, we are not going to have not met the 15% reduction goal by 2015, and we are not on target to meet the 30% reduction goal in greenhouse gas emissions statewide by the 2025. The color chart shows the economic sectors that are included within our total greenhouse gas emission inventory. The tall blue chart is the electric generation sector, and this includes imported emissions from imported electricity. But what you'll see there is that was the only sector that was able to achieve at least a 15% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2015. They are on target to meet the 30% reduction by 2025, and that is being achieved through the renewable energy standard, the electric efficiency standard, and then the market-based decisions that are being made by the electric generating utilities in Minnesota to switch from carbon-intense fuels like coal to wind, solar, and then some natural gas. And then also the role that nuclear plays in stabilizing the rest of the electric generation sector. Transportation is the green sector. It's had some reductions we've seen. That's primarily due to a slight reduction or leveling out in vehicle miles traveled, but more significantly due to increased fuel economy standards at the federal level. And one of the concerns that we have is that with recent announcements at the federal level to revoke or revise and make less stringent those fuel economy standards, we're not going to see the future reductions we anticipated from this sector going forward. The yellow is the agricultural sector. That includes both the animal husbandry side and the crop and the crop agriculture. And I'll be talking the rest of the presentation of just about crop agriculture. Talk a little about that in my next slide. But that has been mostly level. And then with the other sectors, they are level to perhaps slightly increasing. And they're much smaller impact on the entire greenhouse gas emission inventory. We think that for industrial, residential, and commercial, that's based on increased natural gas usage. And we think that is both tied to just expanded use of that and also the cheaper prices for natural gas being increasing the use for those three sectors. And then the waste sector, a very small part of our emissions inventory, but going slightly up. And as I said, this presentation will focus on just the expanded pie chart here, the cropland greenhouse gas emissions that are included in the agricultural and part of the greenhouse gas emission inventory. And the primary pollutants, climate relative pollutants that we look at for this sector are nitrous oxides, and that comes from the cycling of nitrogen in the soils, and it has emission points of both within the soils, and it can also, if it's washed away, can have emission points in surface waters. downstream once the nutrient is washed away. And it's dependent upon the amount of nitrogen that's available in the soil, the pH of the soil, the temperature of the soil, and the moisture content of the soil. We also have carbon dioxide emissions, which is represented by releases and storage within soil organic carbon and the cycling of carbon within the soil, and also include emissions from the combustion of fossil fuels for the care and maintenance of the cropland, and the manufacturer carbon emissions from the manufacture of nitrogen fertilizer, and the use of urea and the manufacture of other amendments to the soil. And then finally, we have methane, which is typically generated and released by the soil by microorganisms as they participate in the nitrogen cycling and geochemistry processing. And just to note that nitrous oxide and methane are both more potent greenhouse gas warming chemicals than carbon dioxide, based on how they act and how long that they respond into the atmosphere. So getting down to what our studies had found, we had one of our climate scientists studying this, Peter Siborowski, was reviewing a significant amount of literature that has been assembled since we last looked at the way to best estimate greenhouse gas emissions or accumulation based on agricultural practices. And the literature has expanded quite rapidly, so Peter went through and mined quite a bit of that work and came up with new emission factors that allow us to compare what those greenhouse gas emissions will look like, especially most appropriate for the application within Minnesota's climate and other conditions. What the table you have in front of you on this slide are, we took the top 8 of the most effective mechanisms that can be applied to cropland nutrient reduction and other practices, and then normalized them to a 100,000 acre application. So what you see would be the greenhouse gas reduction potential for each of these types of nutrient management practices if they were applied on a 100,000 acre basis. And if you would assume that some of these could be applied at greater than 100,000 acre basis, we just multiply these emission reductions by how many hundreds of thousands of acres we're able to apply, or fractions thereof. And so while some of them may be lower on the scale, for example, the reduced tillage at 6,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalents per 100,000 acres, that may be a practice that is more easily applied to many hundreds of thousands of acres than some of the other ones, so that it's a way to calculate what the climate benefits would be, and also to be able to incorporate some of these terms into decisions and analyses that are looked at about how we are protecting our water quality from nutrients and how that can also be a co-benefit for the climate. So the takeaway from that initial work was that most of the practices that reduce nutrients getting into water from cropland use also have a net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And that if we were to apply these kinds of practices throughout, and looking at the next part of my presentation, I'll go through the nutrient reduction strategy. If we were to apply those strategies on the amounts of land that were identified there, we could see a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the cropland ag sector. And that greenhouse gas reductions are a co-benefit of protecting water quality through nutrient reduction practices. So this is a summary of the types of practices that are included in the statewide nutrient reduction strategy. And we grouped them on the types of geochemical processes that we'd be looking at. So we're looking at the changes in fertilizer use efficiencies, the increase in targeting living cover, and then reducing field erosion and tile drainage for water quality treatment. So looking at each of those individual groups of nutrient reduction strategies, we see that applying nitrogen at the recommended rates, and these are the rates that I think came out of the University of Minnesota study, shows that we can get more than a million ton decrease in greenhouse gas emissions based on the geoprocessing of that nitrogen in the soil. And then with some of those other reductions, they actually show an increase. And that's just, again, based on the processing, the geochemistry of adding that nitrogen at different times. That is because that nitrous oxide emissions are sensitive to temperature. So if they're applied at higher temperatures, we'll get more nitrous oxide coming off the soils. The placement of the nitrogen into the soil, we are seeing that if it's placed below the soil, it's in a area that's lacks oxygen, and then that increases the nitrous oxide emissions of what we look at. But again, with these three, once we total those up, we still end up with a net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from those practices. And then looking at increasing the and targeting the living cover, we were looking at these three broad categories of conservation reserve program, and including in for using grass as the cover crop, including other kinds of cover crops throughout the agronomic season, and then riparian buffers. And again, because of the changes in the processing, the soil processing, the accumulation of soil organic carbon, and in some of these reduced amounts of emissions from fossil fuels for the farm machinery that's needed, we see reductions in greenhouse gas emissions based on these types of nutrient reduction practices. And one of the things that we had to note here is we had to make a best judgment on how long would these kinds of practices be in place, because that's the sensitivity piece for greenhouse gas emissions. We assumed that these kinds of practices would be in place for 20 years. And we know that that could be a stretch for some of these. 10 years may be more appropriate. Some literature will look at 100 years. We thought that 20 years was a reasonable amount of time to look at these practices being in place. And then also, we put the numbers up for grass application in conservation reserve practice. These numbers will double if those are converted, if those are considered in trees. So for replanting trees, we get much more greenhouse gas reductions. With conservation tillage residue retention, is keeping material on the soil to keep it from running off. Again, we see a net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the application of that type of practice. And that also is about the avoiding the runoff, keeping the organic carbon, the soil organic carbon, and also some of the reductions in fossil fuel emissions from that application. And then finally, the one that we are continuing to work on and look at is the constructed restored wetlands. This one, we actually would see a potential for increased greenhouse gas emissions, and that's in the form of methane, because these kinds of, certain kinds of wetlands would be better emitters at methane than if they were not converted to wetlands. But we're also looking at the literature to show how these can be engineered and built in a way that you actually can get a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It's about managing amendments that go into those wetlands and the types of plants and the types of wetlands that are being built. We think that continue to research this and look for the opportunities that these could actually be ways to both sequester carbon in the wetlands and also minimize the amount of methane that's generated by the soil and the plants. So our final note is what we're finding is nutrient reduction is equaling climate protection. And we think that there is a continued benefit to incorporate this kind of study. These emission factors, this kind of data that's underpinning the numbers that you saw here, will be included in our next round of greenhouse gas emission reductions that go in our report to the legislature. And we're looking at this as other ways that we can encourage other practices that are being done, particularly for another purpose, but also how can we estimate greenhouse gas emission reductions when they do benefit the climate. With that, I will be open for questions, and Peter is available for the very technical questions if you want.
Questions for Frank or Peter?
Yeah. Well,
technical question. I was always of the impression that there was 4 tons of carbon sequestered per acre of grass. But you think your graph suggests that there's 1 ton of carbon per acre of grass. Have I got my numbers wrong?
I don't know if Peter wants to answer that specific question. I know that what we were based on, there are ranges that we're looking at, and it's dependent also on where the studies are taking place. So whether or not it's a 1 or 4 ton, I'd let Peter, if you want to.
I think what you're just catching is when you convert carbon to carbon dioxide multiplied by 4. And so that's what the confusion is. So these are expressed in terms of tons of carbon. You move kind of backward. And it's probably not 1 ton. It's probably closer to half a ton of carbon, actually, when you look really hard at it. The literature is these systems are very, very noisy. And so for every 3 articles, 3 pieces of research, you see carbon increasing in the soils when you retire them in the grass. You have one where it doesn't move at all, or it actually declines a little. Noisy systems, I think the agronomists are still relatively confident, but somewhat suspicious of the higher numbers now. So things keep moving back a little bit.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Either Peter or Frank? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for hanging in to the better end.
No problem.
Public comment. I don't have any slips signed by anyone that wants to make comments unless somebody came in. Any members of the public care to comment? If not, I believe we've.
Sorry. Nope.
Chair. Go ahead.
So next meeting, members, you'll get an update from EQB staff on the wild rice working group, which, just in case you're unaware, the governor, there are two pieces of legislation that the legislature brought to the governor for wild rice. The governor vetoed both of those bills in the course of the legislative process. He did then order, by executive order, a wild rice working group to be formed, and that is something that got assigned to the Environmental Quality Board to organize. So Will Seufert and his staff are working on that. The announcement is out right now for members of that working group, and there's an executive order. If you have interest or want to see any of the background information, I've got materials here, but there'll be a full briefing on that at the next meeting. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Other comments? Seeing none, a motion to adjourn is in order.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign. Motion carries. Meeting is adjourned.